And you're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and this is the Food Talk Show, an hour of discussing and quite often tasting innovative food and drink products, food tech, food trends, or just about anything to do with food and drink, really. I am joined by my fellow presenter, the lovely Guy Routledge, co-founder of The Food Rush. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Sue. How are you today?
I'm very good. I've got a double Murray.
A double Murray?
Yeah, I've got double Murray. So I've got Martin Murray, who's on the phone from Scotland to us.
It's and a bit a long way for him to come, isn't it? I guess we had to get him on the phone.
I've got Pippa Murray as well. So we've got two Murrays.
Double Murray.
Double Murray.
No tennis involved, though.
No tennis involved.
Just food.
But we're going to be tasting some gin. Oh.
Now, Sue, I don't know why you've done this to me. I told you last week that I'm having a dry May.
I know.
And then sitting in front of me, I have a whole bottle of vodka and a whole bottle of gin.
But it means that I get more.
Well, this is work-related drinking, so I think it's probably allowed.
Okay,
For the benefit of the listeners.
You can smell it. Now, we all know that gin is big in London at the moment.
There's certainly a lot of it out there.
Yeah.
Which is great, because I love it.
It is very exciting. And of course, as you know, gin can be incredibly complex. I haven't touched it yet.
Are you sure?
And nuanced. But actually, in its most basic form, it's incredibly straightforward. Basically, you take a neutral base spirit. Most often it's made from grain, but it could be anything. Yep. It could be potatoes, for example. And then you flavour it with botanicals, as everybody calls them.
What's a botanical, Sue?
Well, botanical could be anything. So most commonly used botanicals are things like coriander seeds, angelica root, citrus peel, cassia bark.
Cardamom,
herbs,
I've seen.
Of spices, yeah. And essentially what you do is you throw these botanicals in. It's actually going to be much harder than that. Martin will tell me it's much harder than that.
I'm sure he'll set us straight in a minute.
He will do.
He'll make us sound stupid.
The only stipulation to be called gin is the dominant botanical must be juniper. And it has to be at least 37.5% proof.
But sounds good to me.
You didn't know that, did you? Most gin makers put their botanicals through the distillation process. But actually, it's possible to make gin by steeping. And I have to say, I do this at home.
Oh, do you? You make your own gin?
The problem with steeping it, though, is often it will colour it. So I do raspberry gin.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So when raspberries are out, you know, sort of June, July, just pick some raspberries. Steep it, by which I mean shove loads of raspberries in the actual bottle. And I'll just leave it for about 6 weeks. And then I sort of strain it.
Yep.
Gorgeous. It's absolutely really, really
And it's
really
funny
lovely.
Because normally you would think if you put a whole load of fresh something in a bottle for a number of weeks, it would just go off. But the alcohol kind of preserves it and keeps it okay.
It will colour it, though. So
nothing wrong with that, though.
Yeah, well,
I guess like your slow gin and your damson gin, which I've made a couple of times, which is fantastic. And actually the best thing to do is to make a jam with the leftover fruit after it's sat in your gin for a few weeks.
Giving it some
and you have auntie. A nice boozy breakfast.
Yes, exactly. if you want it clear, though, you could pass it through a water filter jug a couple of times and that clears it quite a bit.
Okay,
so at its very basic level, it can be quite simple to make. Before we talk to Martin, because he's been doing some incredible stuff up there, can I just give you a little bit of a history lesson?
Please do. I feel like I need to learn today.
You need to learn. Well, gin was popularised in England following the accession of William of Orange, who was Dutch.
He was a Dutchman,
yeah. And he came along in 1688. And we were having a row with the French.
Aren't we
Nothing
always?
Nothing changes, does it? It was no different in the late 1600s because the government passed a range of legislation trying to restrict brandy imports so the French couldn't sell brandy over here.
Was that what kicked the whole thing off then?
Yeah, British quite like the old brandy stuff going on. And so the government passed all this legislation and encouraging gin production, which at the time seemed like a jolly good idea.
It does sound like a good idea. So the idea was that normal, everyday people would just started making their own spirits at home and, you know, doing whatever they want with it.
Yeah, but also people who
are selling it.
Yeah, but also sort of commercial people selling it, you know, in street corners and shops and all that sort of stuff. And old Queen Anne, she was quite
partial.
She was quite partial as well.
There's a name for it, isn't it? It's like Mother's Ruin.
Yes.
Is that that's to do with the whole whole thing? It kind of, you know, so much gin out there that everyone just started, you know, turning into.
Well, it wasn't just nutters. That. There's a whole number of things, isn't it, that always sort of collide in order to make this happen. And actually, the price of food dropped naturally around that same time, and income grew, and so people didn't have to spend so much money on food. They had a bit more money in their pocket. They really quite liked the old gin, and really that was a bit of a. It was a bit of a problem, really. And it was called, officially, the gin craze. It feels like we've got one at the moment.
A different kind, though. Slightly more calm. Oh,
and all sorts of things started happening. You know, there was debauchery.
There was riots, wasn't there?
No, it was later on.
That was a bit later.
There was debauchery and the famous sort of gin lane etching by Hogarth and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, the government had to do something. There was terror on the streets, yeah. they tried a number of times to try and stop it in various ways. But in the end, they had to pass the Gin Act, which put loads and loads of money, you know, on top of a price. The price of it.
So taxed it, basically.
Essentially.
They're good at doing that, aren't
they? Like to them cigarettes, actually, isn't it? They tried to tax it out of it so people couldn't use them. Anyway, violence broke out. Those were the riots, by 1743... You know, it says here that England was drinking around about 10 litres of gin per person a year.
By what year, sorry? 17...
So this is like the mid-1700s.
Okay.
So it really had taken hold. Bishops were upset and magistrates were
all sorts
upset.
Of drama.
Yeah. Anyway, eventually it all calmed down, as these things do. And people went on to...
I think you're skipping quite a large part of the story there.
Yeah.
Eventually it all kind
of... I think part of it, the legislation worked, but also food went up again. People didn't have as much money to spend.
Yep.
You know, and that was a big sort of thing.
In my notes here from kind of the early 1800s, there was I was having a look at some of this stuff earlier, and they were talking about alcohol consumption in that period. And in one year, from 1825 to 1826, the amount of alcohol consumed jumped from 3.7 million gallons in 1825 to 7.4 million gallons the following year.
In one year. Wow.
It was a thirsty bunch of people.
So after having that little history lesson, I've got Martin Murray on the line from Dunnet Bay Distillery. Hi, Martin. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi there. Now, given that we have this rather tortuous relationship with gin, on and off, us sort of British, you must be pleased with the renaissance in gin and also some of the incredible flavours that we're finding.
Absolutely. It's such an incredible time for gin at the moment. We're seeing real diversity within the category, and it's just fantastic for the consumers. It's just a great experience. You're seeing gins that are being aged and cast. You're seeing gins that are using seasonal botanicals. And then you've got gins that are using really unusual ingredients, which is just brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Now, you've supplied us, even though you're on the end of a phone, you've managed to get some person, I don't know how you've managed this, to deliver us some Scottish vodka and some Scottish gin here. And I've got Pippa Murray of Pip and Nut, and we've got a little bit of gin in front of us. They've not supplied us with any tonic, though, Martin, which is a bit disappointing. So
we're going to have to drink it neat,
No.
What you're saying.
Oh, goodness me, no. I'm going to put a tiny bit of water in mine. So we're just going to taste the gin that you've made here. And the one that we've got here is the Rock Rose. Can you tell us a little bit about that while we're having a little snifter?
Yeah, actually trying it neat or diluted down with water is quite a nice way to try gin. It's maybe not the way I would drink it all the time, but certainly when I'm doing the tastings here in the distillery, I would have it with water, normally in equal measure. What you get from our gin is a lot of complexity, actually. We've got 18 different botanicals in there.
I can taste lavender. Have you got that?
Yeah, it's really floral.
It's very floral.
Yeah, so one of the ingredients is rose root, which we harvest locally. And rose root's really unusual. It's almost like a cabbage plant when you see it growing in the cliffs. But the root itself is very earthy Turkish delight. And that's what I would call one of the building blocks that we use for our gins. We've got these really earthy floral notes, and then we complement it by using bilberries, we use sea buckthorn berries, we use grains of paradise, cinnamon, cassia. So you've got a lot going on there, but at the very centre of it is this rose root.
Yeah, I'm just really looking at Pippa. I've never had gin with water, actually, yeah. But I'm converted already.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hit you in a way that makes you kind of cringe or anything. It's really smooth. It's probably because it's such good quality.
Also, for me, it doesn't add an extra layer of taste profile, yeah. Which tonic, you know, does.
And yeah, I don't it can overpower actually like it,
fizzy,
can't it?
Fizzy
yeah,
stuff. Yeah. It is incredibly complicated.
Mm. I guess it's a very common way to drink whiskey, isn't it? You have a whiskey with a bit of water sometimes. Interesting idea.
It's incredibly complicated. And the earthiness and the floral is interesting. And I've still got that. It's a very long taste as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the sweetness that hits your tongue that actually, I normally expect something to be a bit bitter and actually hit other bits. But it's really nice and sweet.
Martin, getting a thumbs up here.
Yeah.
Big thumbs up.
Great to hear.
Yeah, good. We would tell you if we didn't like it as well, trust me.
Brutally honest around here we are.
Pretty brutal. So you produce two multi-award winning craft spirits. So your Rock Rose Gin and the Holy Best Vodka. And I know you've
Holy
got
grass.
Loads. Holy...
Is it Holy Grass or
Holy Grass?
Holy Grass.
Holy Grass, yeah. And I know you've won lots of awards with it. Can you tell me, about... Well, how on earth did you start getting into making gin?
Wow, this is going to be a long story. But
it's fine. We have loads of time. We have loads of time. It means that Pippa and I can keep drinking.
When I was at university studying chemical engineering, I wanted to do brewing and distilling, but at the time there was no jobs and I had a fairly substantial student loan. So I went into the oil and gas industry and worked there very happily for 11 years. But at the same time, I was still working on a hobby, making beers and experimenting, doing what you said, which was compounding. So taking raspberries, taking different berries and soaking them in vodka, soaking them in gin and just trying to learn. And then one day I decided that we'd build a shed and we'd do it as a hobby. And then it kind of grew arms and legs and we built a bigger building than a shed and we bought a bigger still than we anticipated. And then
I presume that Martin by that point everybody's trying to invite you around to dinner all the time hoping that you're going to bring loads of your bottles with you.
It's the time in your life where you're the most popular you'll ever be when you've got free samples.
You've got free booze.
Yeah, what you tend to find is people who have borrowed things that you never expect to see back come back with these things.
That's funny, isn't it?
What a surprise. Yeah. But you were saying that there's something like 18 different botanicals in your gin, and I'm assuming that took a little bit of experimentation to get right.
Absolutely. What we did was we worked out what ingredients complement each other, how to actually create that flavour. So we had a hot still, we had a vacuum still. So we're trying to understand how flavour interacts, and then also what we could do with local ingredients, because we distill in our home village and we wanted to have part of our area in each of the products. So we tell the story of the gin, we tell the story of the vodka, but within each of those recipes there's ingredients that come from within about 5 miles of the distillery. So we get berries from the forest, and yeah, it's great to tell people about our area because we are so remote. We are quite a fragile community.
Because you're right at the top of Scotland, aren't you? Right, like the most northern part, or the most northern county, I believe it is. Caithness, isn't it?
Yeah, and Dunnet Village. The distillery is the most northerly village on the mainland. So we distill just miles from Dunnet Head, which is the most northern
part, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a fantastic place, but it does have its challenges as well.
Well, we're just about to taste, not having, drunk enough gin, we're just about to taste your vodka. Can you just tell me what Holy Grass is? It's very special, isn't it?
Yeah, I love the story of Holy Grass. So when I was researching the recipe for the gin, I came across the Holy Grass that was first discovered growing on our local river, Thurza River. And I loved the taste of it, absolutely incredible taste, but doesn't work so well with juniper. They tend to cancel each other out. So I then started to play with it and experiment and what we could do with it. And in my research, I realized that Holy Grass is bison grass. The Polish create wonderful vodka called bison grass vodka. And I thought, well, let's try it here and done it. So we created a recipe and a methodology to create Holy Grass. And it's just a completely different spirit from anything that's out there. It's got a nice warmth from the cinnamon, and it's got a little bit of sweetness from apples that we get from the Black Isle. So that's not quite local, but it's within 80 miles of the distillery.
Mm, but close enough, I guess.
Yeah, it's close
we've
enough.
Just, we've just been given some posh glasses, actually. So we've got some posh glasses now.
Gin and water out of a posh wine glass.
I know.
Very fancy in the Food Talk studio this week.
Thank you to Louise, the engineer, for organising that. Shall we go again?
Yeah,
you weren't expecting this when we said, would you like to trot along to the Food Talk radio?
Not at all. Not at 1 o'clock away. In the afternoon. Yeah, exactly. No work is going to get done this afternoon.
Ooh. So everybody else is busily tasting the vodka and water
now
blend.
I actually think that's quite creamy.
Yeah, the vanilla grass is just lovely. It's such a soft flavour. It's just something that's a product of our imagination up here. It's not something that anyone had ever done in the UK before. So we kind of had to do it from scratch, which is challenging. But, you know, it's really, really good fun.
I feel like you can really taste... maybe it's just because you said the word vanilla, but I feel like I can taste
cream.
It. Yeah, it's got that kind of
ice creamy flavour.
Really, because normally vodka is you tend to keep it as a fairly neutral spirit so that you can mix it with all sorts of other things. Mm. But this sounds like it's got some really distinct kind of notes to it.
Yeah, I can taste some herbiness. Is that something coming through as well, Martin?
That will just be the back of the grass. So at the front of the when you distill the grass on its own, you very much taste the vanilla at the front. And then at the end, you get more herbal, savoury elements from the grass. But that's almost in the finish.
So what do? You just sort of walk out your front door and trot along and cut some grass. And how does it work exactly?
It's not far from that, actually. We tried to grow the grass here in the first year, but we got our soil pH wrong, so it didn't really do so well. But this year we've got a lot of holy grass growing, so the only thing that's unfortunate for us is we can't pick it from the local river because it's a protected area, so we've had to grow it here on our own. But what we do is we buy in some dried holy grass to complement the local grass that we use as well.
And you've got a traditional copper pot still, haven't you? And you have you given it a name?
Yeah, it's called Elizabeth. It's named after a lady who loved the area and was partial to gin and Dubonny.
That's a traditional thing, though, isn't it, naming the still?
Yeah, it's always...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm sure that I've heard this in all sorts of places. I go to a few places that either distill on-site, or I went to this wonderful place in Portobello Road called the Ginstitute, which is where I learnt about gin and then drank too much and promptly forgot everything that I learnt. I've heard this idea of naming the still in a number of different places.
Yeah, we've liked to keep with tradition. So one of the other things that we did was we seasoned the still, which is where you go out and you collect local ingredients that are in season, and then you distill them in the very first batch, and that then is said to give you good luck with your business and with your distillery. So
Seems
we took the
working.
Kids out and gathered some heather, some gorse, and we did that for our first batch.
Well, it does seem to be working, because currently I believe you've got 10 staff and you're aiming for 12 by the end of the month, and turnover is already 1.2 million for your year ending 2016. So seems to be going very well.
Yeah, a lot better than what we'd expected. We were quite pessimistic about how a rural business could compete with bigger brands, but actually people love what we do. The product looks great, feels great, and it tastes great. So believed in the product, but we just didn't expect it to get the traction that it's had so far.
And you're in Fortnum & Mason and Harvey Nichols. Pippa, you've actually started a brand, which I think the packaging in particular has really made it stand out and has helped tremendously. You've got really good shelf standout. But you've taken on the sort of big boys as well, haven't you? Like Sun Pat and I don't know whoever else it is.
Yeah,
and all that stuff.
Boys.
Yeah. Do you think people really want to go for a smaller brand if they can? Because somehow it feels like they don't really want to go with the big boys if they can help it, although price is a big consideration, of course.
I mean, there is a kind of authenticity that you get through a smaller brand, but fundamentally I think it comes down to what the product is. Often, the reason why you start a business is because you're trying to solve a problem or you're unhappy about a product that you have been purchasing for a while, which was the case for me. And actually, I saw a gap in this category because of the fact that most brands weren't putting ingredients in that I didn't agree with. So I think, you've got to tell your story. I think it's the thing that people make makes people brand loyal. But fundamentally, your product has to stack up. I think consumers are a little bit fickle, let's be honest. They will shop from brand to brand. So you've got to make sure that whatever it is that you're doing is better than your competitors. Mm-hmm. And having a bit more integrity to your brand, because of the fact that you either put your name on it or it's something that you've crafted, like these guys, you know, you put your passion through your product, and it hopefully translates in like the quality that you're putting on the shelf.
Well, we're great fans, I would say.
Absolutely, yeah. When I go off my dry May, I'm gonna, you know, hoover up some of this.
And where else can we get it, Martin? So I mean, obviously, if you're up in Scotland, you can't trot down to Fortnum & Mason's, but I presume you have it other places too. Can you buy it online?
Yeah, you can buy it online. It's available in Jerry's of Soho, Majestic Wines, Oddbin. So it's quite good distribution, actually. Oh, it's getting better at the moment. It's just going from strength to strength.
Very good. And it's Dunnet Bay Distillery. Do you have a website where people can come and find out more about you?
Yeah. The best way to do it is through either rockrosegin.co.uk or holygrassvodka.co.uk, and that'll take you to our main site.
Holy Grass Vodka. Well, you can't go wrong with that.
Perfect.
And I've just noticed on your bottle, each bottle has a little label that's handwritten, tells you the bottle number, and presumably who's given a little taste to make sure it's okay as well, which is lovely.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all hand-waxed, hand-numbers. It's got a nice feel to it.
And that's brilliant. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Martin, and good luck with it. I'm converted.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
My pleasure too.
Cheers. Not bad at all. What do you think?
No, I really enjoyed that. Mm. Thanks for inviting me on that. That's brilliant.
That's not what you expected, was it? On a
So have it, this first time I've ever had to drink gin and vodka on a kind of any kind of interview. So
on a Tuesday afternoon.
On a Tuesday afternoon
in the middle of London. Right. Well, we're going to have a really good chat about how Pip & Nut has gone. I have to tell you, I do. I'm a customer of yours.
Oh, fantastic!
It's the almond butter.
Just pure and simple.
Not the peanut butter. The almond butter.
Okay.
And I do go to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're laughing there, but I do. but for me, we had the, is it the, I always pronounce it wrong, is it Moma or Mama guys on here, the porridge guys?
I think it's
guys.
Mama.
Yeah, and they make great porridge with these sort of big oats, and it's delicious. And they were on the programme, and they were saying, oh yeah, porridge goes really well with peanut butter. And I'm going, really? No, that's just rubbish. Anyway, I bought some of your almond butter, and that's porridge and almond butter. Couple of teaspoons of that in there, and it's absolutely lovely.
It makes it super creamy and just like really unctuous. I love it. And in fact, actually, when we look at like all our social media and people tag us all the time in their meals, porridge is the number one.
Is it really?
More than toast, more than smoothies.
I guess it probably looks a bit better. It's a bit more Instagrammable, as the kids would say
exactly,
these days.
Exactly. Yeah, right. I know. I love that's now a word that I use
crazy,
in my vocabulary.
It?
Like, not.
It's that verb. Before we go into that, we're going to have a little listen to Elsa from iRaw. And she makes incredibly good raw snacks, and we caught up with her at IFE a few weeks ago. So let's have a little listen to Elsa, and then we're going to have a long chat with Pippa Murray.
Okay, so we're at the IFE show, which is a massive show at London XL, full of fantastic companies, and I've come across Elsa from iRaw. So hi Elsa, welcome to the Food Talk show. Can you tell me a little bit about how today's been going?
Yes, hello. Thank you for stepping by. It's been fantastic for us to be here at the show. We met some amazing companies and from around the world, basically. And we just launched iRaw Healthy Habits just 6 weeks ago, and we've got fantastic feedback. I think what has helped is that one of our products got shortlisted as a finalist in the Innovative Food Award, which has sent people basically to come and visit our stand. But then again, we also, I would say it's very useful for a young company or even a more developed company to come to meet fellow or people like in the industry, and also people that just to expose your product, what you do to them. But we are quite unique because our products are fully certified organic, and they're also vegan. Plus they're raw food because of the way they're produced. They are dehydrated at low temperature, up to 42 degrees, which makes the food alive and the enzymes intact. And we seem to be the only one at this show, and we're getting a lot of attention for that. So, yeah, I'm thrilled.
Yeah, so in terms of your product, is it sort of, I say obviously it's raw product, but is it sort of the nibbles that you're looking at, things like that, biscuits, snacks?
It actually, the basic idea is, because I'm a raw foodie for around the raw vegan for about on and off for 13 years now, vegan for up to 20 years. For me, it was basically to share my lifestyle in the beginning. That was the idea, because I came across that was difficult to get even a lunch or snack in between, or to stay just healthy and good throughout the day. So our range is actually 5 different categories, and then we think about being able to provide the consumer with breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks in between, and desserts.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've seen in the last few years, obviously, there's been a big trend with vegan and gluten-free. Do you think that's down to sort of there not being the choice sort of beforehand, before companies started popping up and doing these sorts of products?
Yes, I believe so. And I think also there is a huge increase in people being or developing intolerance for this or the other. So like now the latest, I find that people are intolerant to mustard seeds and celery even. And I think it's because now what I can say that raw food helps you with is that it provides you with enzymes to help you to break down the food, which I think is personally is one of the main reasons that people are suffering, because they are having difficulties of absorbing and breaking down the nutrients and the food itself as it has been, because it's been highly processed. And that is also what gluten or products containing gluten, like flour, etc., that the body is just basically saying, I've had enough.
So how long has the business been going?
We launched 6 weeks ago, but it's been 3 years in development. It's been absolutely fantastic time. Twice I've almost launched, and then I always went back to the drawing board. The first time I only had 4 products. Today we have launched with 17 products. And the second time we almost launched is that I had this fantastic question from one distributor about the flavor changing when you upscale to mass production. And then I thought, okay, no, let's go back to the drawing board. And now we are ready for mass production. We have like big machinery in place. We can produce up to 3,000 units of cookies, for example, an hour. And yeah, it's very, very exciting.
Yeah, obviously you've just mentioned, obviously the company's in its infancy, shall we say. So I mean, in the next couple of years, obviously you've mentioned about, you know, mass producing, but are you hoping to sort of get it into supermarkets, or what direction do you want to take?
No, absolutely, because we are moving into a bigger production space. Which enables us to go through accreditation, which then opens doors into super bigger grocery stores and also Ocado, etc. So, so that is just around the corner.
So have you had lots of sort of interested customers today then?
Fantastic. We get orders everywhere from, or potential orders, I should call it, from Italy, Finland, Dubai, and China, God knows where. So I'm saying this is a fantastic opportunity to come and see and be seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, can you tell people a little bit about more where we can find your products?
Yeah, Iroh is now already, in such a short period of time, we are stocked in 13 shops, and we are going into 16 more shops this week. Plus, we got big orders from loads of subscription food boxes. And so that is rolling out now in the next couple of months. And also from our online store. Plus, there is an online shop called Yumbles. So they're going to be offering our products as well. But so it's iroh.uk.com where you can find the products. And we can send to you wherever you are, basically.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with the whole project, and thank you for talking to the Food Talk Show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And that was Elsa and her raw snacks. Right, back in the studio. We are going to talk about nuts in a minute, but you just were off air talking about vodka again, weren't you? Can't resist
it. Yeah, no, that's it. Once it gets started, that's me on a road.
We're all kind of mellowing out nicely now in the studio.
I know. In terms of nerves, I'm completely relaxed. So it's all good.
We should do this for all of our guests.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe not.
So tell me where you're based and why you're into the old vodka.
We're based in Hackney Down Studios, which is obviously in Hackney. And we're lucky enough to be right by a gin distillery. So they're a really tiny, tiny outfit. And for our Christmas party, I was just saying to these guys in the break that We actually did a kind of gin tasting, but also gin making, where we had basically the opportunity to craft our own gin and throw in all the botanicals and play around with it, name it, and then get a bottle of gin to take away with me. But I gotta say, it's just nowhere near that stuff. Like, mine was a bit hodgepodge, and by that point, I'd had two glasses of gin, and I was chucking in, you know,
anything,
all sorts of stuff.
It is great to be able to use all these different botanicals and really create your own profile of the things you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing. Like, it just amazed me how, because there was a whole team of us all making our own gins, they all tasted so different. And it, you know, that some could be very warm and some could get quite bitter and spicy. Mm-hmm. It blows me away.
Mm. Well, let's talk about you. So your mum and dad thought, oh, Pippa should go to university. No idea what she's going to do with her life. I know she's going to do anthropology, geography and humanities at university. Mm. So off you trot to University College London between 2007, 2010, something like that. And there you were studying to be a, I don't know what that makes you qualified to do. What does that make you qualified to do?
The thing with anthropology, super, super interesting subject.
Really interesting, isn't it?
Fascinating, loved it. But it is quite a niche degree.
What is it exactly, for anybody who doesn't know what anthropology is?
I mean, essentially, it's the study of kind of like tribes and small scale communities, to kind of, I guess, a social science, really. Mm. You know, you can go into all sorts of different things from that, you know, from being a museum curator right the way through to, if you want to be a natural anthropologist, everything in between. And often a lot of marketeers are anthropologists because you use...
It's the study of people, I guess.
Study of people.
Useful information.
And behaviours, people's
behaviours. Yeah, exactly.
I think I'm just nosy. I think that's why I like
it. And how you influence them.
But you did end up working for a museum, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I did vaguely use it. So I actually was working at the Science Museum, which was the job before, the one I quit to start Pippa Nut. So I was working as a theatre producer, but in a museum context. Which was great, and I'm not one of those people that's come from a big bank and quit their investment banking job to start their real dream. I quite like the job that I was
doing.
So
you're in the Science Museum, you're an anthropologist, you're trying to get kids and all sorts of people involved in understanding science and all that. 2014, I know, I'll go and make peanut butter.
I know, this is the thing that's really hard to connect the two together.
It is. Yes, it is.
I often find the most interesting people are like that. They did something completely random, and now they do something completely other random at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, and it's the funniest bit is telling your boss at the Science Museum that you're going to quit and start a nut butter brand. That really hits, like, you know.
I heard about this bloke who decided to leave to make cakes.
Yeah.
And what he did was he left a cake on his boss's desk and said, I've gone to make cakes.
Be back. Dot, dot, dot.
Might not be back. Yeah. I presume you didn't do that with your peanut butter.
No.
So you left. I can't imagine what your friends and people must have said. Mm. Must have said you were mad.
Nuts.
Pun intended.
Exactly. Mm. I mean, the thing is, when you're starting a company, you kind of, well, at least my approach was that I kind of drip fed into it. I didn't quit my job and then just go full on into it.
Thank goodness.
Took me about 2 years to, you know, actually get the products launched. So for the first year, I was working part-time. Mm. So it wasn't like you pull the rug out of underneath you and just kind of run at it. But having said that, the conversation with my mum and dad when I first told them, I think they thought it was more like a WI project, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, my mum and dad always thought I was going to go and do English university. Yeah. And then I came home one day and I've been thinking about it an awful lot. But they didn't know I'd been thinking about it. And of course, then you just say one sentence and they think you've just thought about it overnight. And
exactly.
I said, Mum, actually, I've decided to go to art college. Well, they went bonkers.
Wow. Yeah.
You're going to have green hair and this is going to be taking drugs. And no, I'm going to study to be a designer, Mum. You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's something that you obviously are thinking about all the time before you make that decision. Nobody just makes a decision just like that, do they?
Yeah, I think so. For me, this product kind of really started to get under my skin. So the idea behind it actually came about because I run a lot. So I've done loads of different marathons. And I think naturally when you're a runner or any kind of, like, I wouldn't necessarily call me an athlete, but certainly someone that was really passionate about it, you naturally do think about what you're eating, you know, before a run, after a run, these sorts of things. And for me, I've always been completely addicted to peanut butter. It's really sad, really tragic, but I love the product. And I just noticed one day, and I don't really remember exactly the light bulb moment, but I remember looking at all the ingredients on the back of the product that I was buying most of the time. and it always had palm oils and sugars, and that was something that twigged in my mind that I was like, not really sure if I like that. And it really, that's where the kind of ball started rolling.
I also think with your product, which I eat myself, the almond butter in particular, I think with your product, it hasn't got that, you know, sometimes you get peanut butter and it sort of goes on the roof of your mouth
cloy-y.
And it's almost like, oh, it's when you eat a really raw banana, you know, that sort of does.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have that with yours at all. And yet it's not, because it's oily.
Mm.
So when I have the Whole Earth, is it Whole Earth peanut butter? Lovely though it is. For me, it's too oily, because that's how they get around that. But yours is roasted nuts, isn't it, with a little bit of salt. And somehow that gives it a much better texture.
Mm, I mean, we mill our nuts twice and obviously pay attention to like how much we roast them and things like that because of the flavour profile. But I think particularly when you've got a product which literally has two ingredients in it, so that one in particular, just almonds and sea salt, you kind of have to pay attention to those raw ingredients and be really specific about what you're putting in there. Same with peanuts. There are specific, all different variants that you can choose. Certain ones have different flavour profiles. You have to pay attention to what you're putting inside it.
So with a product like that, which is just such a small list of ingredients, how does it work between batches? Like if you were to cook at a slightly higher temperature or a different part of the oven, I mean, I don't know exactly the kind of machinery that you use. Is there any kind of issue with difference in that kind of flavour profile between batches or between jars?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you always buy the same kind of raw materials, and you obviously work with suppliers that you've worked with that are going to provide you with a consistent product. And then in terms of, you know, just your processing, I guess after a while you do just set processes. But yeah, you can find that sometimes the roasting grade might be a little bit higher or a little bit lower, and it will affect, like, I mean, if something's very heavily roasted, it'll be a bit more bitter, just because it almost that can like lean into being a bit burnt. But so you have to be mindful of that.
I guess you have a quality control process to make sure that if something does go a bit over or a bit under, you then it just doesn't go out the door.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk about palm oil for a minute. I do religiously look at stuff to see if it's got palm oil, because I won't have it if it has.
Yeah.
And for anybody that's listening doesn't know, it's a type of edible vegetable oil, really, and it's derived from the palm fruit. And today palm oil is grown throughout Africa, Asia, North America and South America. And 85% of all palm oil globally is produced and exported from Indonesia and Malaysia. And most of the time it's not using sustainable measures. Now, everybody knows that sort of, you know, small communities who are trying to make a living, you know, we all sort of understand that. But the real issue for me is that the industry is linked to deforestation and, you know, in quite a serious way.
They have to cut down so much of the natural habitat just to, you know, to grow these things. So they take up a lot of space and they require a lot of water and stuff like that.
And there's quite a lot of animal cruelty going on, some indigenous rights abuses, I think, where some of it's, you know, produced. And it is said that an area the equivalent of, you know, 300 football fields of rainforest is cleared every hour to make way for palm oil production.
It's just a staggering stat, isn't it?
It is. And so you get species like orangutans and stuff, you know, really getting displaced and aiding in their extinction. And the same with Sumatran tigers. And therefore, for me, I really can't understand if you do get that, we have a little bit more money to spend perhaps than most people. You should be making that choice and voting with your feet and not buying products with palm oil. I guess that's one of the bases from which you started.
Yeah, 100%. I think the thing is with this palm oil and this particular product is that it actually has no kind of taste or it doesn't add any taste to it. It's an aesthetic thing.
It's just cheap.
Cheap, and it bulks it and it basically solidifies it and creates a stable kind of solid product. So it doesn't need to be in there. It's just something that almost like part of the work that we do is about having to educate people about, it's a bit runnier, but that means it's 100% natural. But I 100% agree with what you're saying there. A key reason as to why I didn't want it in any of our products was the fact that it's, you know, has this massive environmental impact. And I think awareness of that, of what you're talking about just there, is starting to increase. I think consumers are more and more aware of products that contain palm oil. But it still astounds me when you do look at packaging, you know, from cereals to makeup. You know, they might be phrased in slightly different ways. Might say it won't explicitly say palm oil, but it's all over the place. But there are lots of regulations and government kind of pushing brands to do the good thing and start taking out those palm oil products.
And I'm sure there is some of it that is kind of grown sustainably and used, which is, you know, worth mentioning. But As you say, if it doesn't need to be there, if it doesn't really serve a purpose, I actually thought it was more of like an emulsifier, but I don't think I've got that right. It sounds like it's more of a bulking agent, is it?
Well, it's like a stabilizer, so emulsifier, but stabilizer, exactly that. So we get a bit of oil on the top of our products. So you're right, it kind of would stop that oil separation, as an example.
So now I've had a rant about palm oil.
I know. So you
basically, Science Museum. We loved it and all that, but started doing a bit of part-time peanut butter making and left in July 2014. Founded Pip and Nut in January 2015. So we're talking about only 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's had the most phenomenal success. Mm. And so many people talk about you as a business, you know, a businesswoman, serious businesswoman with a really great brand, young, entrepreneurial, a bit of a role model, really.
And you've won lots of awards as well.
Battery, God, my hair, I won't be able to get out the door.
you will do, because you just had some gin.
But yeah, no, it's been an incredible journey. I think for me, I actually have not had any business experience, no experience in food and drink.
What I'm saying, it's incredible.
Yeah, really. It's been a bit of a baptism of fire. And I think, I always say, like, you know, I have a great kind of mentors and investors who kind of support me, and now a brilliant team. And I think I always give them a lot of credit, because whilst I'm at the front and my name's in the brand, but actually they do so much work behind the scenes in terms of actually making this business what it is. But we have been really fortunate. I think lots of things play into that. I think it's hard to pin it on one exact thing, but I think it helps that we've got a really great product that's bang on trend.
Yeah.
A brand that kind of resonates with people, it has that emotive feel to it. And also, you know, I think we've been lucky with that. Some buyers have really backed the brand and given us the kind of some really great kind of listings. And
But why is that? I mean, why is that exactly? Because there's hundreds of new products every day. Yeah.
And even hundreds of peanut butters. It's a big category.
And buyers are just inundated all the time. Mm. What is it that is, you know, stood out for them, where they're backing you? Actually, the buyers are quite keen. Can you pinpoint that?
So, I mean, if we talk on kind of like a bit more of a category, what's happening? I mean, the thing is, a lot of, peanut butter and nut butters, they play into like quite big macro trends that are happening in food and drink. So, for instance, sugar's a bit of the demon at the moment, being targeted. And I mean, what that happens in our category, we've got jams and honeys and marmalades, all which are pretty laden with the stuff. And don't get me wrong, I like a good jam. But it does mean that people's tastes are changing. And, you know, peanut butter's great because it's relatively low in sugar. It's high in fat, but high in protein too. And so you've got those kind of like nice health benefits, which people are looking for more products that are high in protein. So it's, you know, that kind of health trend that's running through the category is kind of really helping buyers think, actually, we've got to give more space to this product.
Yeah, but the thing with that for me is it means it's a growing sector, a growing category. But that doesn't then, you know, give you an answer of why yours has done quite so well, because there'll be hundreds of other people going, ha-ha, peanut butter, I'll make that.
Yeah. So I think on that kind of like what we're doing on a brand level that's really getting us like that traction. So for us, we do loads of things. So I think from a product point of view, we always look at innovating. So we try and play around with like flavours. Like we've got a coconut almond, you've got a honey cinnamon cashew, you know, we've got crunchy maple peanut, and that kind of surprise and delight with our flavours. We try and kind of innovate. It's quite simple. We don't make them too like experimental, but you know, those accessible, fun flavours which bring people in. And ultimately, you know, we've got simpler, you know, almond butters as well. So I think our flavour range really works for buyers. But then also, you know, we're a brand, you know, when we sit and look at the category, a lot of the brands on the shelf are quite old brands. They've been there for 30, 50 years. And actually,
and that's reflected in the labels.
And they're labels.
And the ingredients.
Boring, aren't they?
And ingredients, boring. Yeah. Yeah, and it's that kind of brand positioning where we're really fun, really playful, youthful, contemporary brand. And our play is to actually bring a new consumer. So we're wanting that kind of, it doesn't really have to be younger or anything, but that kind of healthy, active person and who are coming into the category. And actually, we do that through all sorts of like awesome marketing stuff, kind of myriad of things from big partnerships with Nike to, you know, digital stuff where we've got a really great kind of growing audience there. So I think some of the things that we do to kind of grow the category and grow an awareness of like things like almond butters and cashew butters, which are quite niche, are actually bringing and like getting buyers interested and excited about the brand.
But then you hold them with that really striking brand, great packaging, and the copy is just fantastic. Yeah. I mean, there's all these little squirrely references and nut references throughout, and it really kind of, you know, gives people something to...
It's playful.
It's playful. People want to read the packaging because there's those little hidden gems and stuff everywhere.
Yeah, I think the beauty in it, it's sort of what... Rock Rose touched on earlier, it's like the detail that you can put into your brand, like the small things are the things that really get people smiling. So for instance, on the bottom of our jars, we have like a little message there, which most people don't really notice, but we got designed bespoke for us to get that in there, and it's just really fun.
But for me, that's called marketing reward.
Yeah.
So what you do is, not everybody will see it, but people who do, they sort of go, oh,
yeah. They even
I'm
get
in
like
on
a
the
deeper,
joke.
Yeah.
I've been rewarded here because I've spotted that and I know other people haven't. And those are the sorts of marketing tactics that are quite important.
Yeah.
That breed loyalty a little bit, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, you know, we've got a challenge of like, we're a smaller brand. You know, we're playing in a category where there are Unilever brands, you know, big hefty guys with like bigger budget. So you've got to think about what are the things that they wouldn't necessarily do. Like, what are the small
details? I'll be too scared to do.
I'll be too scared
too
to do.
Too risky.
Yeah,
well, one of the 100%. Things that you have done recently, which I thought was really interesting, is that you've released a cookbook.
Yeah.
And so you're a packaged goods product or brand. And doing something which is very common in the chefing world, you know, celebrity chefs coming out with books left, right, and centre, TV shows, all that kind of thing.
So but this for a, is this for is a brand Pip to do it with... and Nut, the Nut Butter Cookbook.
Does what it says on the tin, if you know what I mean. I mean, yeah, we launched it in January, so I wrote it about a year ago, and it was brilliant actually, because again, a lot of what we try and do as a brand is kind of inspire people as to how to eat our products. So there are lots of different ways. You don't have to just have it on toast, although it is good on toast. You can have it at lunch in a salad in a dressing, or you know, bake it into brownies if you want. And so the cookbook really allowed us to kind of really bring that to life. And
make a bit of satay sauce.
Bit of satay,
delicious.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. A barbecue. And so yeah, so we managed it. We created a cookbook of like 70 different recipes to really kind of tell the story of like, yeah, this can be done in, it'll put in all sorts of different myriad of cooking
makes
recipes.
People eat more as well.
And yeah, inadvertently you hope that people might start
inadvertently
chucking
in everything. Look at her, look, she's being all naive. Really?
Subliminal messaging.
My business hat on then.
And so are you selling the books, or are you giving them away as like a promotional kind of thing?
Yeah, so we sell them in places like Waterstones and Oliver Bonus and, you know, Amazon, you know,
wherever you get your books from, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So what's great about that for us is that you kind of get your brand also, like your logo in and around
places.
Yeah, places that you would never put your products. So it's nice for brand awareness as well.
That's a really, really smart move.
So in terms of tactics, if anybody's thinking of launching a new food brand, of which there are hundreds of millions of people who...
And some of them even
new
listen
rock
to this
star,
show.
It's a new rock star, isn't it? Starting your own food business. It's important to get into a category where actually there's not as many competitors who are doing something new and different.
Yeah.
I would now not go into gin. Because
so Martin has cornered the market.
Well, it's not just that, but there's so many people who are doing amazing things. It's going to be pretty hard at the moment, and it's a little bit saturated. But if you really scout around, you should be looking at something that's growing, which is what you were doing, a category that's naturally growing for all sorts of reasons. But actually then a category where the competition is pretty fuddy-duddy and old-fashioned and not too difficult to stand out from.
Yeah, 100%. So, for instance, our category, it's very traditional, very old school. And actually, it's really not the most glamorous part of the supermarket. It's cool, you know, it's spreads. It's not that jazzy, is it? When you look at, you know, snacking and all those other, like, front of store drinks, everyone's going after those spaces. Yeah. So if you can find a category which is a bit tired, and actually there's an opportunity for a newer brand to kind of take, a challenger brand approach to disrupting the shelf. So... Yeah, I mean, it's amazing because every year, like you say, there are lots and lots of brands entering the market, all finding small slithers. And I think for me, what's really, really important is that you don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel. Like people, peanut butter's been around for ages. Nut butter's not actually new. Like they've been in health stores for years. But it's just about reinventing it a little bit, doing your own twist.
And showing that it's been reinvented. And I think the thing for me is... Yep, get a sector that's a little bit fuddy-duddy. Do something, make sure it tastes amazing. That's a given. Then you really, really have to look at standout on the shelf, because you can go around the whole of the country getting people to taste your stuff, but that's a pretty expensive. Onerous task, and it's expensive. Mm. If it can stand out and just sell itself, that's really handy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So getting your packaging right is critical. Mm. Did you consciously look at all of boring fuddy-duddy peanut butter labelling and then go, right, chaps, I want you just do something that's completely different from these guys?
Yeah, so about when we started looking at the packaging, it was about 3 years ago, and actually a few of the brands have actually rebranded since, but at that particular point when you looked at peanut butters, a lot of them were all using horizons and browns and like kind of a few trees or something like that, and it was very boring, very staid. And actually one of the reasons why we chose our like kind of white packaging, and it's quite simple, it's not a lot going on there, was the fact that actually, yeah, it kind of was a brown beige, you know, wallpaper that we were looking at. And actually if you can create a bit of pop and a bit of freshness, it really offsets it. But you are a bit that point around getting shelf stand out, because you're not going to be able to stand in front of that, you know, in front of that shelf out of every single Sainsbury's around the UK. That has got to be bang on, because otherwise you're just not going to get the traction and that visibility that you need.
And you need, to be honest, to get somebody who really knows what they're doing in terms of branding. I know a lot of people who do their first food products and get their auntie's niece's brother to,
because it really shows, unfortunately,
because he's a student and, you know, whatever, and it's one of the most important decisions you'll make, and it is worth spending the money if you can get a really good professional on it, don't you think?
I think it's like you know, your whole business is founded on brand. You are a brand, so your brand's got to really stand for the values that you're set as a business. I think you're paying for creativity, essentially. And it's not cheap if you do want a designer that is, you know, got that experience or worked on other brands that you really respect. But you've also got to respect that their creative processes, their talent that you're paying for. And I think that if you do it well once, in the long run, it pays off, and it's actually really cost efficient. You know, it's one outlay that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And if it's good, it's going to last for a while.
Yeah. You could just make small tweaks as you go, rather than having to reinvent yourself every other year and stuff. Mm.
And then, of course, we've talked about this often on the programme. It's about tone of voice as well.
Yeah.
And that must match visually what it looks like. And yours really does that quite successfully, which gives it that personality, that very strong personality.
Yeah, and we're really fortunate. We've got this lovely little squirrel that's like leaping. Mm-hmm. It's very active and like kind of fun, which then kind of like whips into the pip and nut. And I actually love the fact that we've got a character to play with, a kind of icon there, because we have a lot of fun with like that tone of voice. You kind of bring them to life through all the like foraging terminology, or squirreling, or, you know, bushy tails and bright eye bushy tails, sort of paraphrasing. And for me, that's the thing that kind of what I love the most is when you really start to realize that people really love your brand, is when they start like reflecting that back to you. So when they're like tweeting and they're saying, oh, I just squirreled this one away, you're like, yes,
brilliant.
They're speaking your language, they've come into our world a little bit.
They're getting engaged,
which is great.
So who did your copy and stuff like that? Did you do it yourself, or did you hire an agency or a freelancer?
So we worked with a brilliant agency who did the branding as well, called B&B Studio, and we kind of worked together on that copy. So but copywriters do have an ability to condense long-winded copy.
I've got two pages here of A4. Yeah. Can you put it on my label?
Exactly. Condense it down.
Mm. So we're looking. This is the Pippa Murray guide to starting an amazing brand, by the way. So get in a sector that's boring, fuddy-duddy. Stand up from the crowd. Get your packaging right. Get your tone of voice right. And then for you, we've been talking earlier about, it's about innovating. Mm. Get some new flavours in there, so that when you're talking to the buyers, they're constantly saying you've got something new to talk to them about, presume. Yeah. And also, even as far as the packaging's concerned, you're sort of trying to innovate there. So you've got these new squeeze packs.
Yeah.
And again, is it because you can constantly go to buyers and say, you could see what we got now, and stay ahead of the competition?
Yeah, you do have to have a like kind of pipeline of products that you've got in mind. We've got like a limited edition flavour that we rotate out every 6 to 8 months, and that is for us a nice opportunity to like bring a kind of exciting flavour to the table. But yeah, I think buyers, you know, fundamentally, when you launch a range of products, there may be some products in your range that don't work very well as well. So you've got to be able to kind of jump to that and say, actually, that one's not working very well, but I've got something new and exciting. Yeah. Mm. And in the same way, it keeps it fresh for consumers. So, yeah, I think it's really important to kind of make sure if part of your core, part of your brand, which it is for us, is creativity, you've got to reflect that in the products that you're putting out there.
Absolutely.
Whether that's in pack formats or, you know, in different flavours.
Mm. And then for somebody that started off life in the Science Museum, you're a little bit of a marketing whiz, really. Is this? I think this just might be natural.
Natural talent.
But you certainly have really worked out the sort of marketing. And you, what you're going to find, of course, is that people are going to just want to talk to you all the time, Pippa, as the face of the brand. And you're going to have to leave loads of other people to do lots of work for you. But there's things like the pop-up toast bar at Selfridges and your recipe book. It's important, again, to create that sort of chatter around your brand, don't you think?
Yeah, it's funny because like marketing... I think it's like two things. Like it's like marketing to consumers, but you're also marketing to like trade and all the kind of like
exactly.
buyers. It's really tough to get that balance right, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you know, the challenge that you've got as a new brand is you've got to reach new people, but you've still got to retain your kind of core followers, because you know, it's that classic thing of like you want 1,000 true fans who are just ambassadors and they shout about you every day.
You don't want to alienate them.
Become really mainstream. So it's a real fine balance, which I have to say we're still working at, and we're still so new that we're still just about pushing outside of that, those core followers, and you've got to make sure you don't like just dilute it and lose some of those people who have been actually really kind of vocal and celebrated your brand.
Well, I can't believe we're coming to the end of the program fairly soon, so before we do that, what is the Pippa Murray, you know, sort of plan for world domination?
Nut domination.
domination across the world.
Well, nuts is the first up. So I guess this year we're looking at kind of, we've got some new supermarket listings lining up over the kind of next 6 months, which is exciting. And then also we've got kind of our first step outside of nut butter world and into a completely new category. Mm. So for us, anything...
Is that top secret?
It is. Mm. Wait 6 weeks and it should be out. Okay. But anything with nuts basically works. So, you know, we're going into a really exciting area next, and I get really excited about all those new products that we could launch in snacks or drinks or whatever. So,
looking at your face here, I mean, obviously this is radio, but you're just smiling all the time. Are you really, I mean, it must be hard work, but are you really enjoying this? It looks like you are.
Yeah, I mean, I always say there's a rule of like 80% absolutely love it, you know, and you just like love going to work every day. And then there's a 20% you kind of hate it, where you're like, oh, I wish I had my day job back where it was like super easy. But I love that kind of like tension where you're like highs and lows in both equal measure.
It makes it feel worth it though, doesn't it? I mean, so many people, you know, yes, maybe have a somewhat an easy life. They just roll out of bed, roll into work, do their thing, sit there, have a tea break, roll home, blah, 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 go to sleep. I mean, this kind of world of entrepreneurship and running your own business and all that kind of stuff, it's very alluring to a lot of people, but it's bloody hard work.
Yeah, there's a lot of packing boxes. It's not glamorous.
And you've got to make a profit, because if it's not working, you just really do have to give it up. So presumably... I mean, you're talking about marketing and all that lovely stuff, but it's about the sales, isn't it? And making sure that that's sustainable and coming in regularly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the thing that the lifeblood of your business is cash, essentially. If you don't have enough of it in there, it won't last very long. So, yeah, you've got to be mindful of that bottom line without losing quality. You've got to have the commercial edge as well as that kind of creative free-flowing.
Well, you seem to be amazingly, without much experience, just really, really cracking on with it and nailing it, I think, actually.
We're doing well with the puns today,
I know,
aren't
it's like
we?
Cracking, well done.
I'm so impressed. Yeah.
Thank you.
I should have made a list, didn't I?
Missed a trick there.
So if anybody wants to hear more about Pippa Murray and the story and the brand and everything else, pipandnut.com, or I have to say, practically anywhere you walk in now, your stuff's there, it really, isn't it?
Still got
it's
a way
pretty
to go,
hard to
but
miss.
Yeah,
it's
getting
pretty
there.
Hard to miss. And obviously, we also talked to the lovely Martin Murray. So I really
from our friends
impressed
Dunnet
that.
Bay Distillery.
Yeah, really, Dunnet Bay Distillery. Really, really quite enjoyed that. And I would imagine that Pippa, you've been interviewed by loads of people at the moment, but never one starting off with a bit of vodka or gin.
No, that really is a first, and one that I might start doing more often, I think.
Well done. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and again, thank you very much to Martin Murray. If you want to download our podcast, please go on to www. foodtalk.co.uk.
You almost got it out there.
I nearly did. It's that gin. And thank you for joining us, Guy Routledge.
Thank you.
I really look forward to seeing you next week.
We'll see you next week.
Hearing you next week.
Well, you'll see me too.
I can see you. Okay. Bye-bye now.